This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idstey in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. On January 20th, 1961, a poet made political news when Robert Frost graced John F. Kennedy's presidential inauguration with a poem. He had intended to read a new poem entitled Dedication, but the glare of the snow blinded him. Unable to read the text of the new poem, Frost recited this poem from memory.
The land was ours before we were the lands. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts and Virginia, but we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by what we now no more possess. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war to the land vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become, has become, and for this occasion let me change that to what she will become.
Robert Frost reading a poem entitled The Gift Outright at John F. Kennedy's inauguration in 1961. That reading began something of a tradition. Other presidents turned to poets to help launch their administrations. President Jimmy Carter had poet James Dickey read a poem at his inauguration in 1977. Maya Angelou read for President Bill Clinton in 1993. In general, however, poets in America have not had the same kind of political impact as poets such as Chile's Pablo Neruda, Poland's Czesław Miłosz, and China's Bai Dao. But since 9/11, poets have been making news. New Jersey's poet laureate Amira Baraka was asked to step down last October after he was accused of anti-Semitism for his poem Somebody Blew Up America. In February, a poet, Dana Gioia, was appointed head of the National Endowment for the Arts. Also in February, a White House poetry event hosted by First Lady Laura Bush was canceled after one of the invited poets decided to use it as a platform for a protest against the war in Iraq. Tomorrow, at least a dozen state poets laureate will converge in Manchester, New Hampshire, to talk about poetry's role in public life. The two-day event will be the first gathering of state poets laureate ever. So, this hour, poetry and politics. Does poetry matter, and what role does it play in public life? Has poetry helped shape your political thinking, and if so, how? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is New Hampshire Poet Laureate Marie Harris. She joins us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, John. Happy to be here.
First, tell us what a state poet laureate does.
Well, that's an easy one to answer because I think, except maybe in one or two cases, the state poet laureate's job comes without compensation and without a job description.
Mm-hmm. So you keep your daytime job.
You definitely keep your daytime job. Oh, I was paid in kind for writing a poem about the minting of the New Hampshire Quarter, however.
Uh-huh. But ceremonial events, do you participate in any of those?
Let me back up to say that I do. I've been invited to, and I have chosen to accept invitations to write poems for certain occasions. I'm not saying that all laureates do that. Some, mm-hmm. I think, are more maybe not quite as willing to write for occasions. So it kind of is interpreted state by state by the sitting laureate.
Mm-hmm. How many states have poet laureates?
31 states have sitting laureates now, and there are another 10 states that have the position, but they're not filled at the moment.
And what's the motivation for naming a poet laureate? Is it to have someone to read at ceremonial events? Is it to prove that the state has culture Or is it simply to support the arts?
Again, it probably varies from state to state. Of course, the impetus for having a poet laureate was something that was taken from the British tradition of having a laureate who would, in fact, celebrate national occasions. Why any given state in this country has one is a question perhaps we'll be talking about at the conference, because I don't think there's a single answer to that. I do think that it's seen as an honor. It's seen as honoring the state's literary traditions. Yes.
Tell us why you decided to call this meeting of State Poets Laureate in New Hampshire this weekend.
Well, because the job doesn't come with a description, I began thinking about how I might interpret my tenure as laureate. And one thing I wanted to do was leave some sort of poetic legacy, and that I did by writing a New Hampshire alphabet book called G is for Granite. I also wanted to do something that involved other laureates. I began to research who they were, and I suddenly said to myself, well, I'm sure that we've not done this before, that we've never gotten together. And I think it would be very interesting because we've got a lot to talk about in our roles as public poets.
Mm-hmm. How many poets do you expect this weekend? And who else will be there?
There are going to be, at last count, and I say at last count because there's been a couple of family emergencies, 19 poets in attendance, 19 states represented.
Mm-hmm. Why did you agree to become a poet laureate? I mean, doesn't it take away from your personal writing?
It does a bit, especially organizing a conference like this, but it seemed to be a kind of a challenge that appealed to me. I like the public life. I like being with people, and I thought I was honored to be asked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, part of what you're going to be talking about is the role of the poet in public life, the role mm-hmm. of the poet in politics, and mm-hmm. State Poets Laureate certainly have a special relationship with politics because they're political appointees in a sense.
Precisely, yeah.
I'm sure it's an honor to be asked, I wonder, you know, in many cases, poets in these days are seen as counterculture mm-hmm. rather than celebrating the nation's stories and pasts. Is there some disconnect between poets and sort of being official appointees, do you think?
Well, because I don't feel that I am beholden to the state, I feel that I and other laureates represent our states, represent the craft of poetry in our states. I don't think there's a disconnect. The other thing I've been thinking about lately is that poetry has only lately been perceived as countercultural. I mean, mm-hmm. if we talk to our own grandparents, they had poem after poem after poem committed to memory. Poetry was very much a part of daily life. And that as that began to diminish, then the poets who were writing seemed more and more on the fringes of ordinary life. But that's new, I think.
Mm-hmm. So I know you're going to be discussing this weekend. You may come to some different conclusion. But at this point, what's your view of the role of poetry in politics? Where do they intersect, or do they? What's appropriate political commentary for poets to be involved in?
Well, first let me say that there are many, many poets that I know who feel very firmly and strongly that they don't write political poetry. I think of someone like Donald Hall, who specifically says that's not what he does. On the other hand, I'm of the mind that almost all poetry is political in one way or the other, and that poets tend to write out of their own personal daily experiences and interpret the world as they see it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we take political as a word with a small p, we're talking about the environment, we're talking about family, we're talking about social justice, war, we're talking about the ability to speak in this country and criticize without being labeled unpatriotic. And I also think in some ways we're the voice of the voiceless.
Mm-hmm.
And that often we perceive the world and translate it for people who perhaps don't have the skill or the ability to put some of these things in words.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a caller in Norman, Oklahoma, Carolyn. Carolyn, You have a comment or a question?
Yes, hello, and thank you very much for this program. And thank you, Marie Harris, for
being
a poet laureate. I'm actually old enough to remember having seen Robert Frost on that blue black and white TV with the shock of white hair and the wind blowing, and it was very moving even then. But my comment is, well, I very much agree with what Marie says about the role of the poet. I think that we are personal people. I mean, we're individuals who live our personal life, and we bear witness in our writing to the ways in which public life, the larger public life, the political life, the policies of our government, and all the other events going on in the world, including war, have direct bearing on our lives and the lives of other people. And I know I was in Chile during Allende's presidency, and many people whom I knew down there were killed or disappeared, among them Victor Jara, the folk singer.
Yes.
And that event, that time in Chile, had a major effect upon my life and my writing and my sort of sense of calling as a poet to, you know, basically speak about this in my own work. And somehow it's just, it connects all of us to a larger, just a larger life than our mere, you know, our mere sort of monadic existence.
Mm-hmm.
So I am very glad that poetry is having more, you know, is having more of a voice, and poets are having more influence. You know, Sam Hamill with the Poets Against the War website and all of the attention that that brought. And I hope it has a very beneficent, you know, benevolent influence. And what I just wanted to ask, what do you think, or any of the other poets laureate think about the ways in which poetry and poets can have a constructive influence in specific ways? Because, you know, we create concrete imagery, so we always want concrete things to do. You know, what concrete things can we do in our communities that will have that will bring a sort of a global reach to our local areas? I know we have in this area, there's a lot of readings, a lot of Poets Against the War readings. There's the silent peace walk around the Murrah Building, the Oklahoma City bombing site, every Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. And many of us in this area have been extremely involved with all of that. So it's really created a great sense of community in the central Oklahoma area, and I'm sure this is happening all over the country.
Thank you very much, Carolyn.
We'll
ask Marie Harris to answer that.
Well, I won't speak for my fellow laureates. I think that these are kinds of issues that we'll be talking about this weekend, but I'll speak for myself to say that I think that one needs, or simply, I think I need to draw a distinction between social action and the creative act of writing poetry. Sometimes those two things intersect, but I might, for instance, not choose to take social action as a poet, whereas I might choose to write a poem about a particular political issue that concerns me. So I don't think necessarily that those two things are inextricably linked.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder about that, and I'm wondering whether or not when a poet decides that he or she has an agenda, whether that doesn't affect their view of the world and the truth with which they speak.
It's the distinction between the actor and the movie, the distinction between the writer and the work of art. My opinion is one thing, my work of art is another.
Great. We're talking about the role of politics in poetry. And have any poems helped shape your political thinking, or has a poem ever moved you to action? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. If you have a favorite political poem you'd like us to know about, send it in an email. Poet Lawrence Ferland Getty and Wyatt Prunty join us after this break. I'm John Itzty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Itzty in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about poetry and how it can change the way we think about our society. For many, Langston Hughes changed attitudes about race. Here he is in 1955 reading his poem, I Too.
I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, "Eat in the kitchen," then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful we are and be ashamed. I, too, am America.
Poet Langston Hughes. Have any poets or poems shaped your political thinking? You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And with us is Marie Harris. She's the Poet Laureate of New Hampshire. She'll be presiding over a conference of Poets Laureate this weekend in New Hampshire. We're going to go to a call right now. We have Michael in Beavertown, Oregon. Michael in Beavertown, Oregon, you're on the air. Hello.
Actually, it's Beaverton, but that's...
Beaverton.
Yeah, it's a T-O-N, not T-O-W.
Uh-huh. Great. Okay, yes.
I wanted to ask Ms. Harris a number of things. Poetry is the voice of conscience, I think, and it surprises me that lately... we don't seem to be banding together. We seem to be isolating ourselves in little coffee houses and little bookstores and things like that for our little annual readings. Portland, for instance, which is a literary town of all towns, is doing Thursday the first annual Poor People's Poetry and Prose Party at St. Francis of Assisi at 1 o'clock, or well, mm-hmm. 6 o'clock on May 1st for May Day. And we've put calls out for poets, and no one responds because they're kind of like, well, they're going to be reading over at this little cafe or reading that. And we're trying to get a thing where everyone gets together here. I'm wondering, Ms. Harris, do you see something coming out of the meeting in New England
yes.
which creates a national movement for us to band together? Because I think if we become united with our mm-hmm. voices, like with Portland, we want to do a yearly festival.
Mm-hmm.
Where you know people come in from everywhere and families come to hear the voices, to hear good work, to hear people express in prose and poetry. And then I had another little question related to rhyme.
You know, I think we have only time for one question right now, Michael. Thanks very much. Go ahead, Marie Harris.
I'm happy for that question, partly because one of the things we're addressing over the weekend is that these laureates, are coming to New Hampshire and then being sent off on field trips all over the state to read specifically in the sorts of places that the caller mentioned, nature centers, retirement homes, museums, libraries, where ordinary people could gather and could hear the work. I also think that there seems to be, to my mind anyway, quite a groundswell of new energy for poetry readings, for gatherings in less traditional kinds of venues. So I think it's beginning to happen. One of the things I'd like to see come out of this conference is regional laureate gatherings, where states that have certain regional commonalities share their laureates and the work.
Mm-hmm. Marie Harris, please stay with us. The beat poets of the 1950s and early 60s help give a voice to American radicalism and disillusionment after World War II. And those poems in turn shaped the political thinking of the radicals who followed. One of the great voices of that generation and the current poet laureate of San Francisco is Lawrence Ferlinghetti. He joins us now from his home in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
During the height of the beat movement, what were you and your contemporaries trying to do politically? Were you hoping to change things or merely wanting to bear witness to the events of your time?
Well, that was the Eisenhower era, and it was a very repressive time for free thought and freedom of speech. And naturally, we were trying to change things.
Mm-hmm. We've been asking whether poetry and politics mix. Perhaps I should ask you, can poetry be separated from politics?
It's impossible to separate them. You know, even the poem that has absolutely no political subject or social subject is nevertheless political. If a poet refuses to take a position politically or socially, he is abdicating his role as the conscience of the race, and by the very fact that he refuses to take a or make a statement or take a position on a political issue is itself a political statement.
Mm-hmm. I have an email here from one of our listeners who named Andy Block, and he asks, why would poets make particularly good political commentators? Aren't their opinions only about as relevant to politics as those of painters, pediatricians, or plumbers? What would you say to that, Mr. Ferlinghetti?
Well, it depends on what poet you're talking about. If the poet is really a thinker as well as a poet, then you're going to get just as enlightened a statement from him as you would from the greatest philosophers, perhaps. For instance, poets that come to mind who were also thinkers was like Pablo Neruda and Milos here in Berkeley, and Allen Ginsberg,
mm-hmm.
and of course Amory Baraka, and Carolyn Forché,
mm-hmm.
among the current live poets.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of what happened to Amory Baraka in New Jersey?
I'm glad he stuck to his guns, because since when is the poet supposed to be a perfect model of a gentleman and conform to all bourgeois ideals and dictums?
Mm-hmm. Well, you might say since Rudyard Kipling.
How did he get in here?
Well, he was a poet. He had a different view of political propriety.
A political poet, even though he was way over on the right.
Certainly, and he supported British imperialism. Right.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. He was a poet on the right,
mm-hmm.
by today's standards.
Uh-huh. But you're glad that Mr. Baraka stuck to his guns, even though he was accused of anti-Semitism in his speech?
Yes, but as the poem was really saying, it was an attack on all white men. And it just happened that some of the old white men were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a poem specifically on anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. He wasn't attacking Jews.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller. This is Lee in Lansing, Michigan. Hello, Lee.
Hi.
You've got a question or a comment?
Yes. A friend of mine and I are working in Toledo, Ohio, and Lansing, Michigan simultaneously to bring people together with poetry as the common thread to weave relationships between interfaith and intercultural communities in response to violence and extremism in the world today. And my question is, how can we make poetry more accessible to the people on the street? Because it's tended to have sort of an elite air to it, and people are a little bit intimidated, and I'm wanting some tips from your guest to find out if she has any ideas on how poetry can be made more accessible to more people.
Mm-hmm.
I could
Marie Harris, please
weigh in on that one. Yeah, I don't think poetry is inaccessible. I think that it is, as he pointed out, a perception. And I think that if we read the finest poets from the past and the finest poets who are writing today, they are writing in language that anyone who understands the English language can relate to. So I don't think it's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask both you, Marie Harris, and Lawrence Ferlinghetti, can poetry really have an effect in this day and age, or is it too marginalized? Is it overwhelmed by popular culture in a way that it might not have been back in the 1950s and 60s? Mr. Ferlinghetti?
I don't think it's overwhelmed by popular culture at all, because the mainstream culture is really our culture, which is humanitarian, humanist, for truth, beauty, and goodness. And the mainstream culture, going back to the Jeffersonian democracy to begin with, is not being marginalized. I would say that the television culture and what you would call old pop culture is an aberration,
mm-hmm.
our civilization. But the way the poet is going to get a larger audience is to have a public surface to his poems, which I mean a poem should have a public surface, a commonsensual base that anyone can get without any literary education. But then if it's going to be a great poem, it also has to have other levels, subjective or subversive.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Harris, what would you say?
I would agree completely with Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And by the way, it's an honor to be on the same program with you.
Thank you.
It's occurred to me since I've been elevated to this position that the public nature of poetry is not unlike the public nature of other arts. We don't question whether or not a sculptor might craft a memorial for a park. And I think that there is that aspect of poetry that is and should be fostered.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller. This is a question for Mr. Ferlinghetti. Leah in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Hi, yes. I was curious about how you felt about slam poetry.
Slam poetry. Mr. Ferlinghetti?
Slam poetry is often murder on the poetry, but nevertheless it enlarges the audience for poetry just as jazz did. Jazz and poetry enlarge the audience enormously, and so does slam poetry.
Mm-hmm. What do you
like
think,
to
Marie
liken
Harris?
I like to liken it to the professional wrestling versus college wrestling.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. I would say more it's one good thing about slam poetry, it's usually dissident poetry, and I find today's slammers and rappers are much more alienated from society than the Beats ever were.
Mm-hmm.
But we should remember that dissident poetry is not un-American.
Mm-hmm.
I also didn't mean my remark to be critical. I think slam poetry is very exciting, very immediate, and can often be good poetry as well.
Before you leave us, Mr. Ferlinghetti, I want you to read one of your poems, although we only have a minute left. Is it a short one?
Yes.
Oh, please, go ahead.
Dragon's Teeth. A headless man was running down the street. He was carrying his head in his hands. A woman ran after him. She had his heart in her hands. The bombs kept falling, sowing hate, and they kept running down the streets. Not the same two people, but thousands of others and brothers all running from the bombs that kept falling, sowing pure hate. And for every bomb that dropped, up sprang 1,000 bin Ladens, 1,000 new terrorists, like dragon's teeth sown, from which soldiers sprang up, each waving a different flag, as the smart bombs, sowing hate, kept falling and falling and falling and falling.
And Lawrence Ferlinghetti, thank you so much for joining us. We've appreciated talking to you.
Thanks for listening.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence Ferlinghetti is the poet laureate of the city of San Francisco. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joining us now with perhaps a different take on the role of politics and poetry is poet Wyatt Prunty. Mr. Prunty is the author of 6 collections of poetry, the last called Unarmed and Dangerous. He's also writer in residence at Suwannee University, the University of the South in Suwannee, and founder and director of the Suwannee Writers Conference. He joins us now from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What would you say is the role for poetry in politics?
I have a slightly different take on the way poetic language works versus political language. I think the language of politics simplifies. It must do that in order to get a large number of people to do the same thing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast to that, the language of literature and poetry in particular complicates and is designed or meant to unpack the implications of an idea or of an event.
Mm-hmm. So poetry is about layers of complexity.
That's what happens upon rereading a poem. The poem should work, or it should stand on the ground of immediate conviction. When you first read it, you should have a sense that there really is something there, and you should have some understanding of what is there. But the poem should reward rereading, and that's when the secondary levels of meaning come into play, and that's what makes the poem pleasurable to return to year after year.
Mm-hmm. Marie Harris, a poet laureate of New Hampshire, would you agree with Wyatt Prunty?
Well, I would. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think if I'm understanding you correctly, Wyatt, you're speaking about an initial level where the poem is accessible, and that upon reading and reading, the other levels become apparent. Is that what
you're
saying?
That's right. And I think that what distinguishes poetic language from political language is that those second and third and fourth levels of implication mm-hmm. that become clear or become evident mm-hmm. as you return to the poem.
But if mm-hmm. a poet sets out to write a political poem, does it undercut the art?
That's a good question. Had Frost reading his poem at the outset of your program, and the story that goes with that story brings something to mind, and it is that Frost wrote that poem years before the inauguration. He wrote it with no expectation of it being used for an inauguration, and in fact, the poem that he had brought along he couldn't read, so he recited one that he had by memory, and it was a triumph. The poem was wonderful, mm-hmm. but it was written to be a poem. It was written as a poem. It was not written for utilitarian purposes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the rare poem that manages to be both occasional and a good poem.
Yeah.
I think it's very, very difficult. I think it's been done, but it's difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wyatt Prunty, you emphasize the importance of form in poetry, and while you may not be a conservative poet politically, may or may not be, you're conservative in terms of form.
Yeah. Well, that sort of idea goes back to Horace's emphasis on decorum, which was really led to an interest in the reader. That is, writing the poem in a way that it works for the reader rather than is just an expression for the poet. When you come forward to somebody like Dryden, decorum for him has more to do with formal integrity. But the origin of it, as I understand it, really has to do with thinking of the reader and what will work for the reader. I mean, you're not writing for yourself. You're writing for others, and you have to take others into account.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much, poet Wyatt Prunty, writer in residence at Sewanee, the University of South Sewanee, Tennessee, and founder and director of the Sewanee Writers Conference. Also, thank you to the Poet Laureate of New Hampshire, Marie Harris, who's convening a Poet Laureates Conference in Manchester, New Hampshire this weekend. When we come back, we'll be talking about severe acute respiratory syndrome, and we'll be taking your questions about SARS at 800-989-TALK. I'm John Itzte. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.